General, Pickering said, a touch of impatience in his voice. Okay. A new boat, the Sunfish, can be made available for Operation Windmill.
Excuse me? Captain Sessions asked.
Operation Windmill is what somebody in Washington is calling this operation, Pickering replied. I'm sure that sooner or later someone would have remembered to tell us.
As in tilting at windmills like Don Quixote? Sessions asked.
I think that's a good guess, Ed, Pickering said. Go on, please, Admiral. A Sunfish can be made available to you at Espiritu Santo as of 10 December, if that decision is made today or no later than tomorrow. She is a standard submarine. This means she is not capable of carrying all the cargo you intend to take with you, even with half of her torpedoes removed.
Looking the gift horse in the mouth, Admiral, why are you willing to give us a new submarine? Pickering asked.
Because this cruise for her would also serve as a shakedown voyage, Wackham said. Our experience has been that losses of submarines from enemy action or other causes are disproportionately larger when a boat is making its first combat patrol.
Stecker snorted.
In one sense, Colonel, Wagham said, now a little coldly, you're right. Sinkpack would rather risk the Sunfish than the Narwhal. For one thing, the loss of the Sunfish would not be as damaging as the loss of the Narwhal. There are other Gato-class submarines in production. There are no Narwhal-class submarines on the way.
What are the disproportionate losses of submarines on their first combat patrol? Pickering asked.
18%, Wagham replied.
1 in 5 doesn't make it back?
God, I had no idea it was that bad, Pickering replied, visibly shocked. Sinkpack's thinking, Wagham said, is that the Sunfish could make its first combat patrol with a lesser risk of loss than a full combat patrol would entail, despite the hazards incident to surfacing 1,000 yards off an enemy-held shore for the hour or so it would take to offload your men. That would both put your men ashore and get Sunfish back to Pearl with the experience of a first combat patrol under her belt. On the return voyage, after the offloading, she could continue her patrol with the available fuel and half her normal complement of torpedoes.
Jack? Pickering asked. I see their reasoning, Stecker said thoughtfully. But I don't like cutting the material we want to take to Fertig. Correct me if I'm wrong, sir, but you want to give us the space normally taken up by half of the torpedoes normally carried?
Correct. And if the Sunfish carried no torpedoes at all? Pickering asked.
He directed the question to Admiral Wagham, but Stecker answered. We would still be able to carry only about half of what we could take on the Narwhal, right?
That is correct, Wagham said. Which means we could carry only 1/4 of what we planned to carry on the Narwhal, Pickering said.
Correct, Wagham said.
That's not very much, McCoy said, thinking out loud.
I ask you to consider this, Wagham said. There would be room for the communications and cryptographic equipment, a certain amount of small arms and ammunition, medical supplies, and, most important, I would suggest, the gold. All of which, I suggest, should convince Colonel Fertig.
We think of him as General Fertig, Pickering interrupted.
Should convince General Fertig, Wagham corrected himself, that help is on the way.
When? Pickering asked.
Sinkpack has directed me to tell you that you have his personal word that once secure communications have been established, a supply mission using the Sunfish will have the highest priority.
The highest priority or a highest priority? Pickering asked.
The. Absolutely the.
But I have that already, don't I? Pickering said.
Yes, General, Wagham said. You do.
Ken, you're the one going in, Pickering said. What do you think?
Sir, I'm a little over my head talking about something like this.
I'll decide that, Pickering said.
What do you think? What's wrong with what they're proposing?
McCoy cocked his head to the side as if gathering his thoughts, then wondering if he dared offer them.
Nothing against the Navy, Admiral, he said finally. They did a hell of a job putting us onto Makin and then getting us off.
You are on the Makin raid? Wagham asked.
Yes, sir.
Drop the other shoe, Lieutenant, Wagham said.
we did a good job at making, but...
This is going to be the Sunfish's first patrol, McCoy said. Whoever's running the submarine, by definition, and understandably, is going to be a little nervous. We're in the middle of going ashore. There is a sign that the Japs are on to us, and you don't want to be left floating around in a rubber boat between the shore and a submarine in the process of submerging, right? Pickering finished for him. Okay, Admiral, we haven't addressed that. How do we know the crew of this new sub will be up to doing what they'll have to do? I'm going to give Lieutenant McCoy the benefit of the doubt that he's not questioning the courage of the Sunfish's crew. Permission to speak, sir? Lieutenant Lewis interrupted. Admiral Wagham visibly did not like being interrupted, but after flashing his aide a withering look, he said, Certainly, Lewis. McCoy, would it allay your reservations if an officer were aboard the Sunfish who was experienced in making runs like the one we're talking about and was also fully aware of Singpak's personal interest in this mission?
We're back to that, are we, Chambers? Admiral Wagham asked.
Back to what? Stecker asked.
Lieutenant Lewis feels he could make a far greater contribution to the war by going on this mission than by opening doors for me, Wagham said. Is that about it, Chambers?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Lewis is a submariner, Mr. McCoy, Admiral Wagham said. Before he came to work for me, he was on 3 missions to Corregidor.
What I'm thinking, Ken, Pickering said, and I don't want to question the courage of the subcrew either, Admiral, is that knowing
that my aide is aboard, Wagham interrupted, with orders to report to Sinkpack personally when and under what circumstances the Sunfish left Lieutenant McCoy and party might keep them on position until they absolutely had no choice but to leave or be sunk?
No offense, but that's what I was thinking, Pickering said. I also know a little something about, how to launch rubber boats from submarines, Mr. McCoy, Lewis said.
How are you at paddling one of them? McCoy asked.
Probably a little better at it than you are, Lewis said. I can also walk and chew gum at the same time.
McCoy laughed.
You can't be too smart, McCoy said. It sounds to me like you're volunteering.
You are volunteering, Chambers, Admiral Wagham said. You understand that?
Yes, sir, I understand.
Wagham looked at Pickering. Have we an understanding, General?
Ken? Pickering asked. If General Fertig is what he says he is, we're going to need the Narwhal, McCoy replied. I'd rather see her surface a month from now, 2 months from now, and be able to unload a couple of tons of equipment than take a chance on losing everything now, which would also blow our chances to help Fertig for a long time.
Pickering nodded. We have an understanding, Admiral, he said. Lieutenant Lewis, from this moment you are detached until further orders to Operation Windmill, Wagham said.
Aye, aye, sir.
Can you really, Lewis? McCoy asked.
Can I really what, McCoy?
Chew gum and walk at the same time?
Presuming the ground is reasonably level, Lewis replied.
I'll be damned. McCoy likes him, and vice versa. I wonder what Sessions thinks of him. I'll have to ask, Pickering thought.
Ed, he said.
You'll take care of Lewis, find him a place to stay, etc. There's no more room here, unfortunately.
My pleasure, sir, Sessions said.
Colonel Stecker and I are now going to take the Admiral on a tour of Brisbane's famed tourist attractions, Pickering said, starting with the gentleman's bar at the Maritime Club. If Commander Felt calls, General, shall I tell him where you are? McCoy asked.
By all means, Mr. McCoy, Pickering said.
Commander Felt is one nautical experience that I'm sure the Admiral, despite his long career, has not yet experienced.
Felt, Wagham asked.
The Coast Watcher man.
Right, Pickering said.
As a matter of fact, Ken, see if you can get Felt on the horn and ask him to join us. And if Colonel Dupre calls, ask him to join us too. If he calls. I hope he does, but do not call him. I don't want Willoughby to accuse me of arranging secret meetings with somebody on his staff.
Aye, aye, sir.
9. Captain, Lieutenant Lewis said to Sessions, almost as soon as Pickering, Wagham, and Stecker were out the door.
Don't we know each other?
You're 40, right?
Right,
Lewis asked, immediately understanding that Sessions meant the class of 1940 at the United States Naval Academy, Annapolis,
He was unable to keep himself from looking at Sessions' hand. There was no Annapolis ring.
39, Sessions said. I think we had a class in steam generation together. And then the Navy wouldn't take you, and you had to join the Marines?
Why do I think we're going to have trouble with this swab jockey? McCoy asked.
Well, they start out all right, Ken, Sessions said. But then they send them down in submarines, and all that pressure squeezes their brains.
Can I go home, Mr. McCoy? Staff Sergeant Koffler asked. Or are you going to need me for something?
My compliments to Madam Koffler, Sergeant Koffler, McCoy said. Take a jeep. Then call Pluto about 2100 and see if Gimpy has a way home from the dungeon. The general does not, repeat, does not want him driving himself. If he needs a ride, you drive him, and we'll see you at 0800.
Ken, Lieutenant Hart said, I'll go fetch Gimpy.
You stay loose to drive the general. If Felt shows up at the gentleman's bar, they'll probably need somebody to drive them.
Right, Hart said.
Sorry, Koffler.
No problem, Mr. Hart, Koffler said, and turned to McCoy.
Aye, aye, sir.
McCoy waited until Koffler had left the dining room and then opened a drawer in a sideboard, took out a bottle of scotch, and held it up in a gesture of asking if anyone else wanted a drink. Lewis thought,
interesting. The sergeant asked Lieutenant McCoy for his orders, not Captain Sessions. And McCoy gave the orders. And McCoy, not Sessions, announced the cocktail hour.
Yes, please, Lewis said.
Me too, Sessions said. Thank you very much, Hart said.
Hart took a tray of glasses from the sideboard. McCoy splashed whiskey into four of them, announced that only feather merchants used ice, and raised his glass.
Welcome aboard, Swabby, he said.
Thank you, Lewis said.
It will at least teach you something that every Marine learns in boot camp, McCoy said.
I already know how to tie my shoes, Mr. McCoy, Lewis said.
I was thinking about never volunteering for anything, McCoy said.
You volunteered, Ken, Sessions said. Pickering told me.
Knowing you're the only guy available to do the job is not the same as volunteering, McCoy replied.
That's splitting hairs.
I have to go and you know it, McCoy said.
Can I ask a question? Lewis asked.
Depends on the question whether you get an answer, McCoy said.
What about the OSS?
I'm deeply ashamed to confess the son of a bitch is a classmate of mine, Sessions said, and then, seeing McCoy had held up his hand like a traffic policeman, said,
What, Ken?
The general told me I was not to discuss that subject with the Navy until he brought it up with the Admiral. I think that includes you.
Okay, Sessions said.
Do I look like a Japanese spy or what? Lewis asked.
In that white uniform, you look more like a good humor man, I'd say, McCoy said. Next question?
It was said jokingly, but Lewis knew that he was not going to learn anything more about the man from the OSS from either Sessions or McCoy.
Tell me about Pluto and Gimpy and the dungeon, he said.
The dungeon is the special channel place inside the Sweepo Comm Center, McCoy said. Unless you've got a magic clearance, you can't get in there. We're not even supposed to know about it. Pluto, otherwise known as Major Han Song-Do, Signal Corps USA, runs it. Gimpy is Lieutenant John Marston Moore, USMCR, who forgot to duck on the canal and as a result limps. He works for Pluto. They live here. You'll meet them. Next question?
Everybody lives here but the OSS man? Lewis asked.
Next question? Sessions said.
If I really wanted ice for the drink, where would I find it? Lewis asked.
Part 13. 1. Gentleman's Bar, The Maritime Club, Brisbane, Australia. 1825 hours, 29 November, 1942.
Nice place, Admiral Wagham said to General Pickering, looking around the comfortably elegant room furnished with dark maroon leather couches and chairs, its paneled walls holding discreetly lighted oil portraits of men in merchant marine uniforms and sailing ships under full sail. An elderly, white-jacketed waiter appeared immediately as Pickering, Stecker, and Wagham sat down.
"Good evening, gentlemen," he said.
"Are you a scotch drinker, Admiral?"
Pickering asked. Wagham nodded. The waiter delivered glasses, a soda siphon bottle, a bowl of ice cubes, and a bottle.
"We'll pour, thank you," Pickering said, and when the waiter left them, did so. He picked up his glass.
"How about, to inter-service cooperation?" he asked.
How about the Corps? Admiral Wagham said. Jack, NMI, and Fleming, I give you the Corps.
They sipped their drinks.
The Navy, Stecker said, and raised his glass again. How about to the kids we're sending off on Operation Windmill, Pickering said. God protect them.
Hear, hear,
Wagham said. Before we get really carried away, Stecker said, are there any unanswered questions? Have we done everything we can?
I've got a question, Wagham said. About the OSS involvement?
Apparently, Pickering said. Colonel Wild Bill Donovan got the president to order Frank Knox to order me to include two OSS agents in the Fertig operation, which Donovan apparently has decided to name Operation Windmill. When my deputy in Washington, Colonel Rickaby...
I know Fritz, Wagham said.
When Fritz learned the identity of one of the agents and was reliably informed what a... for lack of more forceful words, miserable son of a bitch he is, and protested to Knox, he got a nasty note saying in effect that the OSS, including the son of a bitch, goes on the mission and no further discussion is desired.
Ouch, Wagham said. I suppose it's too much to hope that the agent who was lost,
the good one, is the one who went down with the B-17, Pickering said. Jack had a word with this chap. He's a Marine captain named Macklin, and made it clear to him that McCoy is in charge of the mission even if he is only a first lieutenant.
I'll have a word with Chambers Lewis before I go back to Pearl, Wagham said, and make sure he understands that.
I think that would be a very good idea, Pickering said. Thank you.
I was very impressed with McCoy, Wagham said. He's a very impressive young man, and he has the experience. He made the Makian raid, and he ran the operation when we replaced the Marines with the Coast Watchers on Buka. There's no question he should be in charge.
And we're working on getting a Marine raider to go along, a master gunnery sergeant who was with McCoy on the Makian raid, Stecker said. I think he'll show up in time.
If you don't mind my saying so, Fleming, Admiral Wagham said carefully, there is one thing wrong with McCoy. At least for your purposes.
And what would that be? Pickering said coldly.
He's only a first lieutenant. I somehow don't feel that General MacArthur will change his opinion about Fertig based on the judgment of a lowly first lieutenant.
The original plan was that Jack was going on the mission, Pickering said. He has guerrilla experience in the Banana Republics.
What happened?
The incoming commandant of the Corps decided he needed him in Washington, Pickering said. Stecker looked uncomfortable.
Incoming commandant? Wagham asked, surprised. I hadn't heard that.
Who?
Vandegrift?
You didn't hear that from me, Pickering said. And changing the subject, you're right. McCoy's rank is going to pose some problems. I'm wide open to suggestion.
Send somebody out right away who's been with Fertig all along. The higher ranking, the better. I mean, on the Sunfish.
That makes a lot of sense, Stecker said.
Okay, we'll do it, Pickering said, presuming McCoy can find somebody to send.
I really wish I could go, Stecker said.
You're too old and decrepit, Jack, Pickering said, and reached for the bottle.
2. Naval Air Transport Passenger Terminal, Brisbane, Australia. 0715 hours, 30 November 1942. Lieutenant Chambers D. Lewis, USN, was not surprised when Brigadier General Fleming Pickering and Colonel Jack NMI Stecker showed up to see Admiral Wagham off. But he was a little surprised when Captain Ed Sessions, at the wheel of a jeep, drove up as the Pearl Harbor-bound Coronado, two of its four engines running, began to taxi away from the tie-down buoy. Pickering, about to get into the Studebaker staff car with Stecker, changed his mind and walked up to Lewis as Sessions drove up.
Everything go all right, Ed?
McCoy's all set up, and I've got Lewis the room right next to Macklin, but the telephone's going to take some time, Sessions replied.
Macklin? Why does that name ring a bell? There was a guy at the academy by that name. That would be too much of a coincidence, Lewis thought.
Maybe Pluto knows somebody in the Signal Corps, Pickering said. I'll work on it.
Yes, sir.
Lewis, Sessions is going to set you up in the BOQ.
Yes, sir. Did Admiral Wagham have the chance to discuss the... Who's in charge of arrangements for this mission?
Yes, sir. And to take my orders from Lieutenant McCoy.
If you've got any problems with anything, bring them to either Colonel Stecker or me.
Yes, sir. Thank you, sir.
I hope you brought some bathing trunks with you, Pickering said.
Sir? I got some for him, sir.
Well, then, I'll see you both later at the cottage. Have fun.
I'll try to see that he does, sir, Sessions said.
Pickering walked to the Studebaker.
How's your head? Sessions asked when Lewis slid into the jeep beside him.
I am a naval officer, Captain. Naval officers know how to hold their liquor.
What gets the Marine Corps up at this early hour? And what was that about swim trunks?
First, we're going to get you settled in the BOQ, and next, we're going to show you, or maybe you'll show us, how to get heavy and awkward objects down a curved, wet, and very slippery surface into rubber boats. And then, you're going to practice paddling a rubber boat overloaded with heavy and awkward things round the harbor. And presuming you don't drown today, you'll do it again tonight or before daylight tomorrow.
Really? Where are you going to get a curved and slippery surface?
McCoy found an old coastal freighter that went belly up at a pier, Sessions replied. He rented it for a week from the Aussies.
What do you mean, rented it?
When he asked if he could use it, the owner said, certainly, and exactly how much were you thinking of paying?
I don't think you're kidding.
I'm not. Anyway, he and Kaufler and Hart have been over there since daylight, setting things up. I hope you remember how to swim.
Are you involved in this exercise?
No, I'm not going on the mission. Therefore, I don't have to practice. But I thought I would watch. With a little bit of luck, the OSS might drown himself.
You've really got it in for this guy, don't you?
Let's say it wouldn't break my heart if he did drown this morning.
You gonna tell me why?
What did your admiral tell you?
He said McCoy's in charge and to conduct myself accordingly.
If that's all he said, then one of two things is true. Either the general didn't tell him about the OSS, which means that I can't tell you, or he did tell him, and your admiral decided he didn't want to tell you, which also means I can't tell you.
If you hate this guy so much, why don't you just drown him?
I think that's probably been considered. If anyone had asked me, I would have voted yes.
Sessions reached into the back of the jeep, dipped his hand into a musette bag, and came out with a pair of blue swimming trunks.
Don't let it be said that the Marine Corps never gives the Navy anything, he said, as he handed them to Lewis.
General Pickering used the name Macklin, Lewis said, making it a question.
The OSS officer's name?
That's his name.
I think I may know him.
I don't think so, Sessions said.
Why not?
If you knew him, you'd try very hard not to let anybody know, Sessions said.
Chambers Lewis examined the swim trunks. According to a Royal Australian Navy label on the inside waistband, they were 4 inches too large, and they did not have a built-in jockstrap.
They don't have a jockstrap.
They're Navy trunks, Sessions said. Sailors have no balls, and therefore a jockstrap is unnecessary.
Screw you, Captain Sessions.
But you're right. Some sailors don't have balls. This sailor in particular doesn't have balls.
Lieutenant Chambers D. Lewis, USN, Annapolis 40, had been forced to the conclusion that there was serious question whether he had the balls, the intestinal fortitude, the courage, however more politely the condition might be phrased, to wear the uniform he was wearing, to represent himself as an officer of the Naval Service. He was also alive, he believed, because he was a coward. The first indication that he was equipped with something less than the necessary balls came, as one hell of a surprise, shortly after he reported to the submarine school at New London, Connecticut, 6 months after he graduated from the Naval Academy. During an orientation ride on a fleet submarine before beginning their training, Lieutenant Commander Thomas B. Elliott, USN, Annapolis 32, gave them a little talk, explaining that the makeup of some people simply disqualified them for the silent service. These individuals had nothing to be ashamed of, Lieutenant Commander Elliott said, any more than they should be ashamed of having blue eyes or red hair. It was the way God had issued them. The Navy's intention with the orientation ride was to save both the Navy and the individual whose makeup was such that he couldn't take submarine service, time and money, by sending him back to the surface Navy now, and without any sort of stigma attached, before the lengthy and expensive training began. That, Ensign Chambers D. Lewis knew, was bullshit, pure and simple. Any officer who couldn't handle being in a submarine shouldn't be in the Navy at all. And certainly, a notation on a service record that an officer who volunteered for submarine training and was accepted, and then left New London within a week of his arrival, would be tantamount to stamping the record in 3-inch-high letters, "Coward." Cowards not only deservedly enjoy the contempt of non-cowards, but are unfit to command men, which is the one basic function of a naval officer. Lewis remembered very clearly the first time he heard a submarine skipper give the order to take her down. He had nightmares about it, waking up from them in cold sweats. He was standing not 6 feet from the skipper when he heard that command, and the moment the klaxon horn sounded and the loudspeakers blared, "Dive! Dive! Dive!" he was bathed in a cold sweat, virtually overcome by a mindless terror. For a time, he thought his heart stopped and that he was going to faint. He remembered little else about his first voyage beneath the sea, except that he was aware they were under it, that just a foot or two away the sea was doing its best to break through the flimsy hull and crush and smother everyone inside, including him. Lieutenant Commander Elliot gave them another little chat after they tied up back at New London, and Lewis had a clear picture of Elliot, too. He looked competent and professional, everything an officer of the Silent Service was supposed to be. He wanted to emphasize, Lieutenant Commander Elliot told them, that absolutely no stigma would be attached if anyone decided now that the submarine service was not for them. To the contrary, it was their duty to make their uneasiness known, to save themselves and the Navy a good deal of difficulty down the line. The lieutenant commander went on to say that he knew of a dozen young officers who had the balls to speak up and were now doing very well elsewhere in the Navy, in both the surface Navy and in naval aviation. He would be in his office from 1900 until 2200 that night, Lieutenant Commander Elliot said. If anyone wished to speak with him regarding a release from the Silent Service, they should come see him. Anyone who did so would be off the base within 2 hours, and there would be absolutely no stigma attached to their transfer. He would also be in his office for the same purpose every Saturday morning from 0800 until 1100, so long as they were in training. Ensign Lewis talked himself out of seeing Lieutenant Commander Elliot that night by telling himself that the mindless terror he experienced on the dive was an aberration, an isolated incident that would not be repeated, and that it would be the highest folly to throw away his naval career and the tough 4 years at Annapolis that preceded it because of one incident, an aberrational incident that would not be repeated. And he got through the rest of his training at New London in much the same way, 1 week at a time, telling himself that this Saturday he was going to bite the bullet and see Lieutenant Commander Elliot and tell him that he'd tried, he just didn't have the balls to be a submariner. And every Saturday morning, he decided to wait just 1 more week. He came closest to seeing Commander Elliot after the Malmsen lung training. The training itself, you're inserted at the base of the famous water-filled tower, you put the lung in place, and then you make your way up a knotted rope to the surface, didn't bother him as much as what it implied. Submarines, and thus the submariners aboard them, would inevitably get in some kind of trouble, and an attempt to escape from a disabled and doomed submarine would be necessary. In Lewis's opinion, there was little chance that the Malmsen escape procedure would work as well in combat as it did in New London, if it worked at all. If an enemy depth charge caused sufficient damage to a submarine to leave her without power, her crew might as well kiss their asses goodbye. The various possibilities of dying aboard a submarine ran vividly through his imagination at New London, and later at Pearl, and on patrol, and now in Australia.
He graduated 5th in his class, and after an initial evaluation cruise aboard the Cachalot, a 298-foot, 1,500-ton submersible of the Porpoise class operating out of Norfolk, Virginia, Sub-4 Atlantic, he was transferred to Sub-4 Pacific at Pearl Harbor and assigned to the Remora, another Porpoise-class submarine. By then he had, he thought, his terror under control. At the same time, he came up with a solution to his no-balls dilemma. If he applied for naval aviation while aboard the Remora, no action would be taken until he completed his assignment. His records would show that he was relieved to transfer to naval aviation, not because he quit. And completing his tour, holding his terror under control while he did so, would solve the moral question of whether he had enough balls to remain a Navy officer. He was on patrol a long way from Pearl Harbor when the Japanese struck on December 7th. Remora immediately went on the hunt for Japanese vessels. She found 6 and fired a total of 14 torpedoes at them. Of the 14, 9 missed the target. They ran too deep. Something was wrong with the depth-setting mechanisms. Of the 5 which struck their targets, only 1 detonated. Something was wrong with the detonators. When the Remora returned to Pearl Harbor, the crew were sent to Waikiki Beach Hotel for 5 days rest and recuperation leave. He spent the 5 days drunk in his room, not just tiddly, plastered, happy but fall down drunk. He made 4 more patrols. After each of them, he drank himself into oblivion. And then there was a 5th patrol, the last of 3 that the Remora made to Corregidor to evacuate from the doomed fortress gold and nurses, and on one of them, a 12 men blinded in the war. He woke up after that drunk in the hospital at Pearl Harbor with his head swathed in bandages. He had been found, they told him, in his hotel bathroom, where he had apparently slipped in the tub and cracked his head open. He had been unconscious for 4 days and had lost a good deal of blood, and it had been decided that his medical condition precluded his return to sea until there was time to determine the extent of the concussion's damage to his brain. The Remora, he was told, had sailed without him. The memory of his enormous relief that he didn't have to go out on her again, the shame that he was not sailing with his shipmates because he'd gotten falling down drunk, made him literally nauseous. He was sorry they found him before he'd bled to death. Rear Admiral Daniel J. Wagum appeared in his hospital room 3 days later. There was good news and bad news, Admiral Wagum said. The good news was that he had been declared fit for duty. There was no permanent damage from the concussion. The bad news was that his aide had been promoted, and therefore he needed another aide. And unfortunately, Lieutenant J.G. Chambers D. Lewis, USN, not only met the criteria the Admiral had set for an aide, but was available.
Sir, with respect, I would prefer to go back to sea.
So would I, Mr. Lewis, Admiral Wagum said. But unfortunately, the Navy feels I am of more use behind a desk, and I have decided you will be of more use working for me. They're going to discharge you tomorrow. Move into quarters, take 72 hours, and then report to me at SyncPAC.
Admiral, I don't know if you know why I'm in here.
Officially, you slipped in the shower. Leave it at that, Mr. Lewis. You are not the first officer who had far too much to drink than was wise.
Despite the terrible temptation, Lewis did not so much as sniff a cork on his 72-hour liberty. Afterward, he reported to Admiral Wagum at SyncPAC as ordered. 6 weeks later, it was officially determined that the Remora, 2 weeks overdue for refueling at Midway, was missing and presumably lost with all hands at sea. The next day, Chambers D. Lewis was promoted lieutenant. It therefore followed in Lewis's mind that if he were not a coward, he would not have gotten stinking, falling down drunk in the Waikiki Beach Hotel. He would not have cracked his head. He would have gone on another patrol aboard Remora, and he would now be dead. He went to Admiral Wagum and asked to be returned to submarine service. The Admiral made it rather clear he thought the request was expected and rather childish, and denied it.
And please, Chambers, do not make a habit of making such requests again and again in the belief you can eventually wear me down. If I get tired of hearing them, you'll wind up at Great Lakes training boots, not going back to the submarines. I need you here. You're good at what you do. You are, whether you think so or not, doing something useful to the Navy.
But it was different, of course, when Operation Windmill came up. Operation Windmill was important to the Navy because it was important to SyncPac. Because of his experience, he would be more useful to the Navy aboard the Sunfish, representing Admiral Wagum, and thus SyncPac, than he would be carrying Wagum's briefcase and answering his telephone. If he had not volunteered to go aboard the Sunfish, he could not have looked at himself in the mirror. 3. After giving the matter a good deal of thought, Captain Robert B. Macklin, USMC, finally decided that going to the OSS Brisbane station chief was the wise thing to do, even if the station chief was not happy to learn of the problem. That was to be expected, Macklin concluded. The station chief, he did not know his name and it was not offered, was certainly going to be upset to learn of the death of Major Brownlee, both as a human matter and because Brownlee's loss would adversely affect the mission. It was also understandable that the station chief was upset to learn that Macklin himself was not qualified by training or experience to step into Brownlee's shoes, not to mention his physical condition. And on top of that, it was necessary to inform him of the situation vis-a-vis himself and Stecker, Sessions, and McCoy. If he were the station chief, Macklin decided, he would have been as upset as the station chief was, and in the circumstances, he would have done what the station chief almost certainly did, seek guidance from superior headquarters. In this case, that of course meant going directly to OSS headquarters in Washington for direction. The station must certainly have some sort of high-speed communication link with Washington, Macklin theorized. Perhaps even a shortwave radio system with no other purpose. It should be possible, in extraordinary circumstances like these, to get an answer from Washington in 24 hours, perhaps in even less time. Thus, when the knock came at his door, it was perfectly reasonable to assume that it was either a summons to the telephone at the end of the corridor, or that it would be someone from the OSS, perhaps the station chief himself. He opened the door and found himself looking at a tall, good-looking naval officer wearing submariner's dolphins on the breast of his khaki shirt and the twin silver bars of a full lieutenant on his collar points. "Hello, Bob," Lieutenant Chambers D. Lewis, USN, said, putting out his hand. "Long time no see." It took a moment for Macklin to make the connection, to remember the lieutenant as a midshipman at the academy, to remember that they had served together on a court of honor matter that had seen three midshipmen dismissed in disgrace. "Lewis, isn't it?" Macklin asked. "Lewis Chambers D., 40? "Right," Lewis said. "May I come in?" "Of course," Macklin said, and pulled the door fully open. I knew there would be an immediate response. "I'll be damned," Macklin said, offering his hand. "I expected someone, but the last person in the world I expected was you."
"I'm a little surprised to be here myself," Lewis said.
"My God, maybe he's not from the OSS."
"Lewis, exactly what are you doing here?"
"More or less the same thing you are," Lewis said.
"I'm here on a classified mission," Macklin said, "for the OSS."
"Operation Windmill," Lewis said. "So am I."
"Then you are in the OSS."
"No, actually I'm from SyncPac." "I don't understand," Macklin said.
"What's your connection with Operation Windmill? Who told you about it? It's highly classified."
"Admiral Wagum," Lewis said, "of SyncPac. I'm his aide. I'm being sent along to see if I can make myself useful."
"He's not OSS. He just made that perfectly clear."
"How do you mean, useful?"
"To make sure the submarine goes where it's supposed to go and stays there as long as necessary."
"There may not be a submarine," Macklin said.
"Oh, there'll be a submarine, all right," Lewis said, chuckling. "You can bet on that."
"Things have happened," Macklin said. "I'm not at all sure how much of any of this I'm in a position to tell you, but I can tell you this much. This mission may be scrubbed. Should be scrubbed."
"What sort of things have happened?"
I really don't know if I should be talking about this to you, Macklin said.
You're worried, am I cleared for this? The answer is yes. If you have a question about that, check with Captain Sessions.
He's one of them.
One of who?
I'm not qualified to lead this mission, you know, Macklin said. The man who was supposed to lead it, who was qualified to lead it, crashed at sea.
Major Brownlee, I heard about that. Sorry.
He was a good man, a fine officer. I was his deputy.
Well, unless they send somebody to replace him, it looks like you will have to take his place.
Not only am I not qualified to lead this mission, but I haven't fully recovered from my wounds. I reported this to the proper authority, and they said they'd be in touch. That's who I thought you were, my replacement.
No, Lewis said. A reinforcement, maybe, but not a replacement.
It's not you understand that I'm trying to get out of anything. It's simply that I don't have the training to lead a mission like this.
According to Sessions, one of Pickering's Marines, Lieutenant McCoy, is going to lead it.
McCoy is the first lieutenant, and I'm a captain. The responsibility will be mine.
I don't think so, Lewis said. Not if competent authority, and General Pickering is certainly a competent authority, places someone else in command.
Macklin looked at him with fresh interest. That would be so, wouldn't it? If I am formally relieved of command, then I no longer can be held responsible, can I?
I wouldn't think so, Lewis said. Listen, Macklin, I don't know what's going on between you and Sessions and the others, and I don't think I want to know. All I know for sure is that until further orders, I'm taking my orders from General Pickering. My orders from him are to do what Sessions tells me, and Sessions is waiting downstairs for us.
There is no reason for you to become involved with this, Lewis. It's an OSS matter. The OSS will deal with it.
Sessions is waiting for us, Lewis said.
I have no choice but to go along with this until the OSS acts.
I would be grateful, Chambers, if you were to keep the conversation we have just had between us.
Certainly.
Are you about ready to go? Would you like me to wait downstairs?
I'll be right with you, Macklin said. Just give me a minute.
This man is a coward. What is it they say? It takes one to know one.
4. Office of the Director, Office of Strategic Services, National Institutes of Health Building, Washington, D.C. 0830 hours, 3 December, 1942. L. Stanford Morissette was a 55-year-old Yale-trained attorney who had left his San Francisco law firm and his $300,000 annual income to serve for an annual stipend of $1 as OSS Deputy Director, Special Projects. Though he had a good deal of respect for Colonel William J. Donovan, the director of the OSS, he was not awed by him. Moreover, in his view, Donovan was in error vis-a-vis what he privately thought of as the Pickering-Fertig mess. Morissette happened to know Fleming Pickering rather well. His firm had done a good deal of business with Pacific and Far East Shipping, and thought that Donovan had made a monumental error in refusing Pickering services almost a year before. He also believed that if Fleming Pickering was unable to convince General Douglas MacArthur of the value of the OSS to his SWEPO operation, no one could. And he believed that Donovan's clever little plan to circumvent MacArthur by sending OSS agents to participate in Pickering's Fertig mission without asking Pickering was very liable to blow up in his face and to cause trouble somewhere down the pike. One did not cross someone like Fleming Pickering. Donovan should be smart enough to recognize this, Morissette believed, and didn't. Morissette walked past Donovan's secretary to his open door. In his judgment, Donovan's secretary, like doctors and dentists' receptionists, had assumed to herself entirely too much of her employer's prestige. Morissette did not like to be a supplicant before her desk for permission to seek the great man's attention.
When you have a moment, Bill, Morissette said, there's something I think you should see.
Donovan's eyes showed annoyance when he looked up from his desk, but a moment later his face broke into a charming Irish smile.
Unlike some people around here, you rarely waste my time, Mo. Come in, what have you got?
Morissette walked to Donovan's desk and laid a long sheet of teletypewriter paper on it.
This was just decrypted, he said.
Let me see, Donovan said.
Top secret. Urgent, urgent. Brisbane, number 107, 0900 Greenwich, 2 December, 42. From Chief OSS Station, Brisbane, Australia, to Director OSS, National Institutes of Health Building, Washington, D.C. Subject, Operation Windmill. 1. Your message, number 403-0845 Greenwich, 31 November, 42, Re. Loss Brownlee, received 0715 Greenwich, 2 December, 42. This station not, repeat not, previously advised of incident by OSS Liaison Officer Sweepo. OSS Liaison Officer Sweepo advises your 403 received by Sweepo 1905 Greenwich 31 November 42. Delay in delivery to OSS Brisbane attributed to, quote, large volume of classified traffic requiring decryption, end quote. Situation points out absolute necessity this station be authorized access to special channel communications facilities for urgent traffic. 2. Undersigned had been informed of Brownlee loss 16:15 local time 29 November 42 as follows. A. 14:40 local time 29 November 42, Macklin telephoned emergency contact number and requested immediate conference with station chief. Duty officer suggested rendezvous point. Macklin refused to leave his Sweepo BOQ, stating his life was in danger. Duty officer unable to contact undersigned, dispatched agent to Macklin's BOQ. B. 15:50. Agent contacted undersigned and strongly recommended personal visit to Macklin at BOQ. Undersigned met with Macklin at BOQ 16:15 local time. Found him in highly excitable state. During meeting, Macklin, B1, stated he had been informed of Brownlee loss by Colonel Jack NMI Stecker, USMC, at approximately 11:30 local time, 29 November 42. Stecker informed him that Brig Gen Pickering intended to continue operation regardless. B2, stated that he had requested to see Pickering and this request was denied. B3, stated that he then informed Stecker that he did not feel qualified to lead operation because of lack of training and also because he has not fully recovered from wounds suffered at Gavutu. B4. Stated that Stecker had then told him that although Macklin would be senior officer, mission would actually be under command of First Lieutenant K.R. McCoy, USMCR, who he said was, quote, known as Killer McCoy because he had brutally knifed to death 4 Italian Marines in international settlement in Shanghai in 1941, end quote. B5. Stated that he has had trouble in past with both Stecker and McCoy and that both were former enlisted men conspiring against him to ruin his name and professional reputation. B6. Stated that Stecker had threatened to have McCoy kill him as soon as mission lands at destination. 3. Inasmuch as Colonel Stecker was unknown to undersigned, discreet inquiries were made of Colonel Lewis R. Mitchell, USMC Special Liaison Officer between SINCPAC and SWEPO. Mitchell advises that although he does not know nature of Pickering-Stecker relationship, he knows Stecker, who won Medal of Honor in World War I, is highly regarded by Major General A.A. Vandegrift of U.S. 1st Marine Division, under whom he commanded battalion in Guadalcanal invasion. Mitchell states that from personal knowledge, Lieutenant McCoy is highly regarded by Brig Gen Pickering, and that Stecker told him that Moody participated in Marine Raider Operation on McKean Island. 4. In view of the foregoing and of undersigned's personal belief that somehow Macklin slipped past Psychiatric Evaluation Board vis-a-vis stability, it is strongly recommended that Macklin not, repeat, not be allowed to continue as member of Operation Windmill and that he be released from OSS as unsuitable. 5. Undersigned recommends in strongest possible terms that suitably trained and thoroughly evaluated replacement for Macklin be sent as soon as possible. If this is impossible, 3 agents here are marginally qualified and would probably volunteer if asked. 6. For your general information, Mitchell also advised that Pickering conferred with Rear Admiral Wagham of Nimitz Staff 29 November 42, presumably in re availability of submarine. Time is therefore probably of essence to find replacement for Macklin. Watterson, Station Chief Brisbane, Top Secret.
Donovan finished reading and raised his eyes to Morissette's. Well?
He asked. What do I do about this, Bill?
Aside from finding the idiot who sent this idiot Macklin to Brisbane, you mean? Or are you asking me what we should do to him before we fire him? How about nailing his balls to that large oak tree beside the first tee at the Congressional Country Club? With a rusty nail, of course.
What do we do about Captain Macklin?
What would you suggest, Mo?
A. That we urgent radio Watterson, telling him to go to Pickering and tell him that Macklin has been relieved and a replacement is on the way, and B. Get a replacement on the way.
We can't do that, Mo, Donovan said.
Why not?
What you will do, Mo, is urgent radio Watterson and tell him to keep his opinion of Captain Macklin to himself. The last thing I want Douglas MacArthur to find out is that we sent Pickering this idiot.
Knowing what we do know about him, you'd rather send Captain Macklin on Operation Windmill than suffer a little embarrassment? Mistakes happen, Bill. We made one.
The decision has been made with the approval of the President to send two OSS agents on Pickering's mission to Fertig. If we say, hold it a minute, fellas, there's been a minor little mistake here. One of the agents we sent is paranoid. We're going to look like fools. I don't want to look like a fool before the President, Knox, and MacArthur. Is that so hard to understand?
Not to understand, I suppose, Morissette said, but to believe. What about the other people on this mission? Have you considered the threat to them? To the mission itself of taking this man along?
Subject closed, Mo, Donovan said. Having considered everything involved, it is my decision that Captain Macklin goes on the mission. Claire, send Watterson an urgent radio to that effect.
May I speak frankly?
Certainly.
This stinks, Bill, to high heaven.
I don't like it any more than you do. It's a question of the greater good.
What is the greater good?
That the OSS operate in the Pacific. I believe, and I hope you do, that we can make a bona fide, substantial contribution to the war effort over there. All we have to do is get around MacArthur standing in our way.
By doing this? Sending a man like Macklin on a mission? A mission that very possibly will fail because of him?
The mission will either be a success or a failure. If it's a success, we will have made the point that the OSS is useful. And if it fails, we died trying, Donovan said. Proving that we are willing to make the sacrifices called for. We'll try again and again until we are successful. What we are not going to do is admit that our internal procedures are so sloppy that we actually sent a lunatic like this Macklin on a mission.
We died trying? We are willing to make sacrifices? What's this we business, Bill? We're talking about other men's lives here, not yours and mine.
That's what war is all about, Mo, other men's lives. When we are permitted to operate in the Pacific, we will save a great many other men's lives.
And the lives of the people on this mission are the price we pay for the ability to operate?
You don't seem to be considering the possibility that the mission will be successful. I bet on it. I am betting on it. Whatever else might be said about Fleming Pickering, he's not a fool.
Has it occurred to you that Fleming Pickering, either now or certainly later, is going to make sure the President knows about this?
Let me worry about Fleming Pickering, Donovan said, somewhat impatiently. Is there anything else, Mo?
I'll prepare an urgent radio for Watterson, Morissette said. A draft for your signature.
Hey, you can sign it, Mo. I can, but I won't, Morissette said, and turned and walked out of Donovan's office.
5. Headquarters, 1st Marine Division, Guadalcanal, Solomon Islands, 0945 hours, 4 December, 1942. The Sergeant Major of the United States 1st Marine Division, a large-boned, heavily muscled man who had been a Marine for 26 of his 43 years, pushed open the canvas flap, once part of a tent, that separated the office of the commanding general from the rest of the command post. A tall, dignified man in his early 50s, just starting to jowl, sat on a folding wooden chair before a small table on which sat a U.S. Army field desk. He did not seem to notice his presence.
General, the sergeant major said respectfully.
Major General Alexander Archer Vandegrift, USMC, commanding general of the 1st Marine Division and all forces on Guadalcanal, turned and looked over his shoulder. The general was dressed like the sergeant major, in somewhat battered and sweat-stained utilities.
Colonel Carlson, sir, the sergeant major said. General Vandegrift nodded and made a let-him-come-in gesture with his hand. Colonel Evans Carlson, USMC, commanding officer of the 2nd Marine Raider Battalion, pushed the canvas flap out of his way and entered Vandegrift's office as Vandegrift rose to his feet. Carlson, a large man, was wearing utilities even more battered than Vandegrift's. He carried a Thompson 45 ACP caliber submachine gun slung from a canvas strap over his shoulder, and he wore a web harness from which were suspended two canteens, a compass case, a first aid packet, and a Colt Model 1911 A1 45 ACP pistol. He looked malnourished and exhausted, Vandegrift thought.
"Colonel Carlson, reporting the return of the 2nd Raiders, sir," he said as he saluted.
The 2nd Raider Battalion had been behind the enemy's lines since 9 November 1942, nearly a month. The Japanese, who had somewhat belatedly come to realize that the outcome of the battle for Guadalcanal would very likely determine the future of the war, had, at a terrible cost in ships, materiel, and life, managed to move reinforcements for the 17th Army ashore at Gavanga Creek. Despite all the Marines could do to wipe out the force, 3,000 Japanese had broken through the lines and set out through the mountainous jungle toward Matanikau. Carlson and approximately 200 Marine raiders had gone after them. They had subsisted on rice, on anything edible they could find in the jungle, and on what they could capture from the Japanese.
"Welcome home, Red," Vandegrift said, crisply returning the salute.
"Sir, I regret to report the loss of 16 KIA and 18 WIA.
Killed in action, wounded in action."
"None missing?" Vandegrift asked.
"No, sir. We brought our wounded with us and marked the graves of the KIA.
Vandegrift nodded.
"Enemy losses were 488 KIA, sir. I would estimate time and half that number WIA.
Vandegrift tried not to let his surprise show, nor what he immediately recognized as suspicion. Carlson's raiders were good Marines, well-trained, well-equipped, and highly motivated, but Carlson had just reported that his 200 men had killed more than twice their number of the enemy and wounded three times their number. "And you estimate 488 KIA?
"No, sir. The KIAs are confirmed. There were that many bodies, sir."
"Well done, Colonel," Vandegrift said. "I want to hear all about it, of course. But to save you the effort of telling the tale twice, I think it might be smart to wait until the 1300 staff meeting. That all right with you?"
"Yes, sir. I really need a bath and a change of clothes.
And I'm sure something to eat. Why don't you get a shower and a clean uniform and come back here and have lunch with me?"
"Thank you, sir," Carlson said. "I accept with thanks."
He paused, smiled, and went on.
"And, sir, I would also report the return of one AWOL to duty."
Vandegrift frowned. Carlson smiled.
"Gunny Zimmerman, sir," he said.
"Gunnery Sergeant Zimmerman?" Vandegrift asked. "Of VMF 229?
"Yes, sir,"
Carlson said. "Tell me, Colonel, how did Gunny Zimmerman wind up with the 2nd Raider Battalion?"
"Well, sir, he was with the 2nd Raiders from the beginning. He made the Macon Island raid, sir."
"And then he was transferred to VMF 229?
"Yes, sir. They needed a heavy machine gun artificer, and Zimmerman's about as good with Brownings as anyone in the Corps."
"So I've heard," Vandegrift said. "And then, when VMF 229 was relieved here, the gunny somehow missed the ship taking the squadron off the island. Is that about what happened, Carlson?"
"Yes, sir, that's about it. Zimmerman decided he could make himself useful with us. I'm surprised you know about this, sir."
What could have been a smile moved around Vandegrift's lips.
"Oh, I heard about it," he said. "A number of people in the Corps have heard about it."
He raised his voice and called,
"Sergeant Major!"
The Sergeant Major's head appeared in the canvas flap.
"General, would you run down that paperwork we had on Gunny Zimmerman, please, Sergeant Major?"
The Sergeant Major's head disappeared from the canvas flap. 30 seconds later, he came through the flap and handed Vandegrift the paperwork. Vandegrift glanced at it and then handed it to Carlson. "Secret. Priority. Headquarters USMC, Wash, D.C., 1535, 23 November 42. Commanding General, 1st Mar Div. Following personal from G2 USMC to Commanding General, 1st Mar Div. Dear Alex,
Commandant at Direction Sec Nave desires immediate transfer. G Sergeant Ernest Zimmerman, VMF 229, to USMC Special Detachment 16 attached. To Supreme Headquarters, SWEPO. Air travel priority 6A authorized. Commanding Officer VMF 229 advises G Sergeant Zimmerman presently serving with 2nd Raider Battalion. Please take whatever action is necessary to permit me to advise Commandant that G Sergeant Zimmerman is en route USMC Spec Det 16 and advise by most expeditious means that this has been accomplished. Best personal regards, Horace. And personal to ComGen 1st Mardiv, by direction, Forrest, Major General USMC, ACOFS, G2, Headquarters USMC. General Vandegrift knew Gunnery Sergeant Zimmerman slightly, but he knew his type well. In 1939, the total strength of the United States Marine Corps was 1,308 officers and 18,052 enlisted men, fewer men than were in the police department of New York City. Just about all the officers knew each other. Just about all the enlisted men knew all the officers, and most officers knew most of the enlisted men, at least by sight. Gunnery Sergeant Zimmerman was one of the old breed. Vandegrift remembered him as a corporal with the 4th Marines in Shanghai before the war. If there hadn't been a war, he thought, Zimmerman would still be in Shanghai and still be a corporal. Now there were more than 7,000 officers and more than 135,000 enlisted Marines, and Zimmerman was a gunnery sergeant long before he could have expected to be a buck sergeant. The old breed had been the backbone of the 1st Marine Division here. Without them, Vandegrift had often thought the division might not have been able to do what it had done. And you weren't aware of the gunny's presence or absence, of course, until you were behind the enemy's lines, and there was nothing you could do about it. Vandegrift asked. You don't have to answer that question, Colonel. Marine officers shouldn't lie, and our Constitution prohibits compulsory self-incrimination.
Thank you, sir,
Carlson said, smiling.
Sir, what's this all about?
You know as much as I do, Vandegrift said.
General, the reason I mentioned Gunny Zimmerman is that I'd like to decorate him.
Put him in for whatever you think he deserves. Offhand, I'd be inclined to act favorably on any recommendation of yours. What did he do?
Well, that's what I wanted to talk to you about, sir. Nothing in particular, except kill Japanese.
I don't think I quite understand.
It's rather hard to describe, sir. He takes this war personally.
I don't follow you.
He doesn't talk much. He's a hard man to draw out. But the way I have Zimmerman figured out is that he was the happiest man in the 4th Marines in Shanghai. He had a Chinese wife. Wife in quotes, because they weren't married. But she bore him 3 children. They had a small apartment and were buying a house in her village. What he wanted to do with his life was put in his 20 years, probably making sergeant, maybe even staff sergeant, and then retire to their house in her village. He didn't want much from life. What he had was what he wanted. And then the Japanese came along and ruined it all for him.
A real China Marine, in other words.
Yes, sir. I think, in the back of his mind, he believes that as soon as every soldier in the Japanese army is dead, he can go back to the 4th Marines in Shanghai and his family, and things will be back to normal. So he kills a lot of Japanese soldiers.
Vandegrift chuckled and shook his head.
No individual act of great courage, sir, Carlson said. But he was always willing to take the point on the march, and he's very good on the point. And he was the happiest when he could assume the prone position, get his sling in the proper position on his arm, and then put rounds into the heads of Japanese at 300, 400, 500 yards.
I see.
I don't mean to paint him as bloodthirsty, and he's not foolhardy, but he's very good at killing Japanese. I didn't keep score, but in my mind, there's no question that he killed more Japanese than anybody else on this operation.
Could you, in good conscience, recommend Gunnery Sergeant Zimmerman for the Silver Star? Carlson considered the question before replying.
Yes, sir. I get back to saying that there was no one act of spectacular courage, but he went willingly into harm's way just about every day we were out there, sometimes 2 or 3 times a day. That adds up, sir, in my judgment, to more than one act of spectacular bravery.
So ordered, Vandegrift said. Get him bathed and shaved and into a clean set of utilities and bring him back here. We'll pin the Silver Star on him, and then you can put him on the next plane to Espiritu Santo.
Aye, aye, sir, Thank you, sir. By your leave, sir.
Carlson, having asked permission to withdraw, raised his hand to his temple in salute. One more thing, Vandegrift said. I forgot you were behind the lines and couldn't have heard.
Sir?
We're about through here. On 9 December, next Wednesday, I'm turning the island over to Patch.
Who, sir?
Major General Alexander M. Patch, U.S. Army, will assume command of Guadalcanal 9 December. The 1st Marine Division will be sent to Australia for rehabilitation and refitting.
I hadn't heard, Carlson said. It's about time.
70%+ of the division has malaria, Vandegrift said. The average Marine has lost 22 pounds of body weight.
I didn't realize it was that bad, Carlson said.
It's that bad, Vandegrift said, and finally raised his hand to return Carlson's salute. Thank you, Colonel. That will be all. 6. U.S. Army Air Corps Passenger Terminal, Queensland Airfield, Brisbane, Australia, 17:15 hours, 6 December 1942. 4 U.S. Army ambulances and a complement of medical personnel were waiting for the Army Air Corps C-47 when it taxied up to the terminal. As soon as the wide cargo was opened and an aluminum ladder dropped in place, a doctor, 3 nurses, and half a dozen medics clambered up the ladder. The ambulance drivers started their engines, and one of them backed up close to the airplane and opened its rear doors. The first patient came out the door almost immediately, a nurse holding a bottle of blood hovering over the blanket-wrapped body as the litter was carried into the ambulance. 4 minutes passed before the second litter came through the door and was placed in the ambulance. The doors were closed, and the ambulance moved off to be immediately replaced by a second. 2 litter-borne patients were placed in the second ambulance, and 2 more into the third. The last litter load was completely covered by a white sheet. It was loaded into the 4th ambulance, and then the doctor and the remaining nurse got in with the body, the doors were closed, and the ambulance drove off. A stocky, round-faced, tightly muscled, short, barrel-chested Marine in utilities appeared in the wide cargo door. He looked around the airport, dropped a nearly empty barracks bag from the door, and then, carefully, one hand clasping the leather sling of the 1903 Springfield rifle he had slung from his shoulder, climbed down the aluminum ladder. Lieutenant Kenneth R. McCoy, USMCR, walked up to the Marine and put out his hand.
I figured you'd be involved in this, McCoy, Gunnery Sergeant Ernest W. Zimmerman, USMC, said. What the fuck's going on?
I need you, McCoy said, so I sent for you.
Shit.
Gunnery Sergeant Zimmerman said, and then noticed a Navy lieutenant in khakis walking up behind McCoy. After visibly making up his mind whether or not to do so, he saluted. Lieutenant Chambers D. Lewis, USN, returned the salute.
Zimmerman, this is Mr. Lewis, McCoy said.
Zimmerman just perceptibly nodded his head, then briefly and somewhat reluctantly shook Lewis's extended hand.
Welcome to Australia, Sergeant, Lewis said.
Zimmerman nodded.
I've got a piss bad, Zimmerman said. The fucking relief tube was broke.
Go behind the airplane, McCoy said. Nobody'll see you. Zimmerman nodded, unslung the Springfield from his shoulder, handed it to McCoy, and then walked around the tail of the airplane. 2 minutes later, he returned, in the process of buttoning his trousers and with a look of pleased relief on his face.
Now what?
He asked. We've got to run you past the hospital, and I thought you might be hungry. You want to go to the hospital first or after?
After. What I really would like is a cold beer.
We've got beer in a bucket in the car, McCoy said, pointing to General Pickering's staff car. Zimmerman nodded, took his Springfield back, picked up his nearly empty duffel bag, and started to walk to the car.
What is that, a Studebaker? Where'd you get that?
It belongs to General Pickering.
Who the fuck is he?
My boss. Your new boss.
All I got to wear is what I have on, plus a change of socks and skivvies and a pair of boondockers. My gear's all in Hawaii.
We can fix that, McCoy said. We'll get you an issue. They reached the car. The beer is in the back, Ernie. Get in the back.
What about him?
Zimmerman asked, jerking his thumb in the direction of Lieutenant Lewis.
He will ride in front with Lieutenant Hart, McCoy said.
Zimmerman climbed in the back of the Studebaker, took a bottle of beer from an ice-filled bucket, took a K-bar knife from the small of his back, opened the bottle, and drank deeply, emptying it. When he finally took it from his mouth, he belted